This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Welcome to a special episode of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. We're talking to Demolisher. We're going to be talking with the director and writer, Gabriel Carrere. We're going to be talking with Jessica Vano, who plays the character of Marie. And we're going to be talking with the Demolisher himself, Ry Barrett. We're talking with Gabriel Carrere, who directed In the House of Flies, and is returning with The Demolisher, a film he both wrote and directed, and will be making a strong premiere at this year's Toronto After Dark. Welcome to the show, Gabriel.
Thank you. It's good to be on here, yes.
So, I've seen The Demolisher, and I was quite impressed, I must say. You've got something very unique here. It's sort of like a cerebral vigilante revenge film.
Yes, it's something a little different out of the norm of what is usually seen, I guess you could say, in the vigilante realm. And it's a very dreamy and very moody film. Mm-hmm. That's what we wanted to do, and just wanted to do something a little different, and see what happens.
Yeah, my site partner Chris likened it to The Executioner, or was it Nilga Master gone to grad school?
Sorry, what was that? The Executioner?
The Executioner or Nilga Master gone to grad school. In other words,
wow,
it's
Yeah,
feel free to use it on the DVD box eventually.
I might. Hopefully it's not misleading.
One thing about The Demolisher, I mean, there are a lot of really incredible themes and subtext in the movie that I would like to talk to you about in a moment or two before we get there. First of all, how did the idea for the film come about?
It came about just, I love this genre, you know, and I love horror films. I love hard genre films and stuff, and that's kind of where it sparked it, and then it kind of was just a continuation from my previous film, In the House of Flies, that Angus McCullough wrote. So I guess it's just kind of, you know, taking these familiar genres and familiar films that you familiar yourself with, and then trying to put your own spin and twist on them in your own way, and I guess I just wanted to tell a vigilante film in a different light, and you know, more in the perspective, a psychological perspective, you know, like what's going through this man's head. Because we see a lot of these vigilante films, and everything's very external, meaning, you know, like you see them from a very external viewpoint. Yeah, you see maybe where they live and what they're going through, but I really wanted to go deeper into the mind, so much as, you know, how do they see things, you know, like what's going through their head, you know, like what are their dreams like even. So that was kind of what we wanted to tap into, but I was big into, you know, like some of my favorite films are even Halloween with Michael Myers and stuff, right? You have these like very slow predator stalking type films, and I love the film The Prowler as well. That's one of my favorite ones. So I'm a huge fan of those films, but to go and make that again would just be stupid, because number one, it's been done before. It's with remakes and even just people making movies like that these days with the same kind of thing, but they've been done before and they've been done better with the original. So it's like, why go and waste a bunch of time and energy and money and go make something that's just going to be a crowd pleaser, some candy cane item that's going to be good for a few months, and then people will forget about it in that sense. And why not do something, you know, for yourself and for your team, and try to explore something more in the psychological realm. So we definitely tried to go into the heads, into the minds of, you know, all these films that I liked and some of our crew liked. Whether the Prowler or, you know, Death Wish and, well, maybe not Death Wish, but even the Exterminator, you know. And even Mad Max. Like, I mean, the original Mad Max movie was great because it kind of had that psychological aspect as well. And I know, for me, Mad Max is one of my favorite films. So I tried to be inspired on that psychological aspect of what Max's character was going through in the original movie, not the remake thing. The very, very first film.
No, but you're right. I didn't really think about that, but you're right, because in the original Mad Max, I mean, you do get a sense of who Max is before, and then why he becomes what he becomes, and then you learn psychologically why this man is what he is. So, yeah, that is...
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, there's a lot of... It's funny, because I love Mad Max so much, the original film, that there's a lot of parallels between the original Mad Max and this film, even down to... this is going to sound really funny, but it's not ruining anything, but in this, the Demolisher, Bruce's character, the Demolisher character, his leg gets wounded. I'm not going to say what, but, you know, in the original Mad Max film, the guy's leg gets wounded, and it's actually the same leg as Mad Max. So there is some homage pieces to that, and there's some, even some shots, and even down to his wife, you know, like, you look at Mad Max's wife, what happened, and that kind of drove him over the edge, and the Demolisher, you know, his wife was the seed, the dark seed that this happened to, but, you know, in a sense, she's not dead, but she might as well be, because he's acting as if, you know, the world has ended.
Also talking about influences, I really felt there was a real sort of, it was very reminiscent of Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive. Was that intentional?
It's not intentional, because I would say George Miller and Nicholas Refn and Fincher are cinema gods. Right. They are the best. Also, Alessandro, he's up there, but for people who are still making films, those three are the best, so it's only natural that you gravitate toward trying to adapt some styles and stuff like that from them, and, you know, trying to throw some conventions out the window. But yeah, it's definitely Nicholas's. Ever since, like, I've been a fan of his for over 10 years now. Even the original Pusher trilogy and all that. I love Fear X with John Turturro. Not a lot of people don't, but I loved it. So yeah, there's definitely inspiration from those films and stuff. And I'm not ashamed to say that at all, because, you know, I like them. You know, like, I love the way they look, and, you know, I love his sense of direction. And as a film director, you know, you look for influences and tastes that you like, you know, and you try to get those tastes and put them on your own palette and then do what you can.
Well, I think it's more like tonally. I mean, in terms of the, you know, the sparse dialogue and the incredibly evocative use of music, which in itself was almost dialogue.
Oh, that's important, exactly. And that's the one thing I learned about from Refn's films, is that he only has his actors talk when, you know, it's very important. And he tries to let his actors breathe on frame. And that's the first thing I noticed with his films, is that his actors breathe. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how he did it, but I was like, well, how do we do that with this film? Like, what are some techniques on set that we can let our actors breathe and just engage into the frame instead of, you know, having all this coverage and these typical camera angles and all these things that make the film very mechanical and very formulaic and like an engine. So we just tried to be very organic with it and let the actors kind of run the camera, and we literally did that on set as well with the actors. So we'd set up the frame. We would rarely block, unless it was a fight scene or something. Ryan Barrett was also the fight coordinator.
Oh, yeah.
So we'd rarely block, and then just kind of set up our master, our wide, and see what they do. You know, like, see what happens. Yeah, you know, like, you're making a cinema here, like, what does an actor do? And as long as those actors have enough prep time to do stuff, you know, they can really dive into it, and they did. The cast was phenomenal, and they really did they really dived into it.
Hey, you mentioned Ryan Barrett, and I mean, all the performances are incredible, but I mean, there's something about his performance. I mean, it's pure performance. I mean, again, with minimal dialogue, I mean, you're seeing a man, I don't want to give too much away, but I mean, you're seeing a man, like, literally melting emotionally on screen, and it's quite quite effective. I mean...
Oh, yeah, he went into places that I don't even know how he went into them. I mean, the guy, the Ryan Barrett, was literally, I mean, this role was for him, you know, and I remember writing the script that had him in mind, and I've known him for 20 years. So it was something that I know how he is as an actor and kind of what he needs, and I wanted this to, I wanted Ryan to just take this on his own and go, you know, and I didn't want to put any leashes on him with it. As well, because the character of the Demolisher won't have any leashes on him as well. So he just went with it, and I mean, it's a testament to his acting ability, you know, and his posture and his stamina and everything. Like, it's yeah, like, he's the best.
Yeah, no, I mean, his, you know, it's funny because, I mean, his performance is heartbreaking in a lot of ways, but it's not, and it's funny because, I mean, you said ostensibly, I mean, this is the tale of Demolisher, which is Bruce, but it really is, in my opinion, like a three-character story arc in the sense that it's almost like it's Bruce's film, it's Samantha's film, and it's Marie's film, and sort of like how they all kind of intersect and how they all affect one another.
Yeah, it's, I always believe in the power of three. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the pyramid structure, the you know, the Egyptians used it, and it's a shape that, it's a design that works with any kind of system, mm-hmm. Government or whatever, and even with film, and storytelling, it works beautifully, too. Like, even in my last film, there's three main characters, and that was it. So, with the 3 points, you can really, do some really interesting things with that, and some things can be really focused on, and some things aren't, but the things that aren't focused on can be a really hard foundation for the things that are, like Samantha's character in the film played by Tiana Nori. Mm-hmm. You know, she's probably, out of the three, she probably has the less screen time, but because of her character, this is happening. She is the seed of it all.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, if it wasn't for her, nothing would be happening. Like, so that was another thing that we learned to balance it with well. And then Jessica's role, she, you know, she becomes kind of the scapegoat. And the challenge with her was to not make her too likable. You know, we couldn't make her dumb because it was very easy for these types of films to throw in, you know, a screaming dumb girl mm-hmm. running around with her boobs flopping out and. You know, sure, that would have translated to, you know, bigger sales and all, blah, 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 and audiences and all, whatever, but it wouldn't fit that set of three so much. It wouldn't reflect on the other two. Mm-hmm. The seriousness of it,
yep.
Too, I think, subject matter.
But, I mean, at the same time, I mean, Marie, you're right. I mean, she's not totally likable. And, I mean, in a conventional film, okay, you're thinking, okay, well, here's a guy who's has, you know, a lot of reason to be doing what he's doing, i.e. being a vigilante. I mean, comparing it to, let's say, like, you know, of course, Paul Kersey in Death Wish. And, you know, and you're just cheering the guy on throughout the whole thing, no matter who he's killing, what he's doing. But once Marie enters the picture, and, you know, again, without giving away too much, I mean, all of a sudden you're playing with them. Audience expectations and sympathies, and you know, you're kind of like, well, wait a second, I want to root for this guy, but at the same time, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to say too much, but
yeah, well, you totally are, you know, you are in a sense rooting for her for sure because mm-hmm. you know, because you know, she has a past that you know, I think that every person might be able to relate to or know someone that can make right to, you know, and. She's obviously suffering something that she has no control of, and then she's thrown into a situation where she has some sort of control of, but what she does with that control is something different, and that's kind of, you know, the spice of why you would vote for her.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny too because, I mean, you're right. I mean, they make an incredible counterpoint because, I mean, both are, you know, I would say it's safe to say are suffering from mental health issues due to circumstances, and yet you know, they have two very different coping mechanisms in the face of tragedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have, when you're looking at the way Bruce copes versus the way Marie copes, it really is quite profound in terms of, you know, how we sort of pick up and go on when something terrible does happen to us. The other thing I thought was really, really interesting was, you know, really, like, again, like, what is good, what is bad? Who is good, who is bad? You know?
There is no good or bad. You know, and that's the thing, like, when you go nuts and go crazy and lose your mind and go out of control, I mean, we've all been there, you know? We've all had girlfriends pick up with us, boyfriends pick up with us. We've always been really pissed off at something or someone that died and you know what I mean? Like, there's always moments in our life, you know, whether, you know, it's something that we're dealing with. It's not bad or good the way we react, it's just the way we're reacting as humans, you know? So, I just don't go and defend Demolisher's actions, you know, for beating up certain people in the film, but every person in the film that he goes against is not necessarily, it's almost a worse person than him, except there's one scene where that's the trigger, and that was very important for that to be the only scene, the repair man scene.
That was the one
scene there, you know, the first time someone innocent is involved, you know, and it's his mind giving in to his madness. I don't know where I'm going with this, but yeah, no one's evil in it. No one's like the evil doer, you know. There's none of that.
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, no one's pure good, no one's pure evil, but at the same time, it's not, I mean, the film doesn't sort of, like, moralize in the sense of saying, okay, well, this is the good guy, this is the bad guy, this is who you have to, basically, you present these characters, and you leave it up to the audience to decide, who are you going to root for?
Right.
And for some, it may be, for a lot of people, for a lot of genre fans, it'll probably be Bruce, because he is kind of kick-ass, you know.
Oh, totally, like, the scene of him walking down the street, and with the score cut out, and then it's just silence of his armor, you hear his armor walking down the street, I mean, it's a very powerful presence, you know, like, something about, the wide scope of the frame, too, we wanted to make whatever he was in his uniform, we tried to shoot wide and different angles to make it look like the city was even afraid of him, because that's why he's in the center of the street, and it's almost like the walls and the storefront are afraid to even be near him, you know, because he's just this gloomy presence, and I mean, what person wouldn't want to have that that strength and that power to go through their day, you know, or to get things that they want?
But at the end of the day, I mean, looking at the, like I said before, the sort of three-pronged character arc, you know, one of the characters, again, I don't want to give away too much because, you know, this anticipation of your After Dark Toronto premiere, but one of the characters' arcs, in my opinion, is truly inspiring. And I think, you know, you probably have an inkling of who I'm talking about.
Not the cops.
Not the cops. I mean, not the security guards. But, you know, the one character who, I guess, in the most sane, rational way, knows how to pick. Well, I don't want to use a pronoun.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And so at the end of the day, I mean, you have dare I say, inspiring message, and this is not what you get in your typical genre of vigilante revenge film. And
No, usually it would be the vigilante maybe, you know, giving you that inspiring message and whatnot, you know? Yeah, I see what you mean, but we also wanted to play that whole element where those two characters, like, are almost the same, too, you know what I mean? Like, they're almost at their last, they're both very desperate, you know, and almost speaking, she almost speaks for him as well, especially during her monologue at the end of the film, even at the beginning. Like, she almost is his voice, too. We wanted those two to kind of be equals with what happened. It's almost like if you were to find your equal, who would it be on Earth, you know? And maybe the Demolisher found his equal.
Well, I mean, certainly a film that I think would reward repeat viewings. And if you watch it in one time from one character's perspective and then watch it a second time from the other character's perspective, you're going to get a different experience. And,
for sure.
And that's a mark of, you know, not just a good film, but, like, you know, great art. So, I mean, I
appreciate it.
None. I mean, I'll be honest with you, when I saw the trailer, I thought to myself, hey, here, this is going to be a really kick-ass throwback to, you know, a good 80s vigilante film, and you get that. You know, you do get that.
There's some elements of that, yeah. And you know what, like, I really have to give it to the producing team, because it's very hard to want to do that. Or, sorry, very not hard to want to do that, where we were on set, and we, you know, we could have had the opening sequence of the film, some awesome thing with this vigilante, you know, like, and we were on set, we had these things lined up where we could have done it, but the producing team were just, you know, even the Demolisher, Ryan himself, he was like, dude, stick with what we have, stick with what you have, you know, like, we're doing something different, we don't need to do, you know, and I'm like, oh, like, should we get it just in case, like, shoot some of these things, like, to really amp it up and give it, and it's like, no, it's not that type of film, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be, I shouldn't say, like, Death Sentence, but Kevin Bacon, because that's an amazing film, it's not as pleaser, but on the other hand, it's also a really awesome vigilante film, but you know what I mean, like, a very huge crowd pleaser.
Oh, yeah, no. Just like, I told you what you were saying.
We could have easily gone down there.
Yep.
I know we even cut some stuff out of the film that would have made it more of that type of film as well. So we really, really held ourselves back from that.
But I understand what you're saying, because I mean, you're right. It could have been very easy to just go straight down the, you know, the pure exploitation elements, like you said before. The
nudity, totally.
You know, more. I mean, there is brutal violence, but the way it, you know, because it's parceled out, you know, in, I don't want to, you know, small doses.
It's sparse out, yeah. And that's one. Actually, we used. we were copying Drive, but we would reference the movie Drive and the violence in that film, because people have to see the film and they're like, oh, that's a very violent film. Well, no, it's not. Like, I mean, there's one scene or two scenes in it. There's the elevator scene with the head bash, and then there's a few others, and that's pretty, there's not that many, there's not much violence in that film. You know what I mean? So we kind of use that as a model for this film, just to, you know, show that you don't need to, like, really show all this. No, you don't need to show all of it to know that it's violent, you know? And I know there's recent films. I can't think of them right now in my head. I know Drive was one that we really, really were referencing, even for color palette and stuff like that. There is violence in it, but it's not, what's the word? It's not cabin fever. It's not, you know...
Well, it's not wall-to-wall brutality, and because of that, when there is brutality, it hurts that much more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, if, you know, I'm a genre fanatic, I mean, I love, you know, straight-up balls-to-the-wall violence and gore and whatnot.
Oh, I'm here. Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you see these movies, and, you know, if it's over the top with a lot of gore, I mean, you see it, you have a good time, and then you kind of forget about it. But I saw Demolisher 2 days ago, and it's still with me. Like, I'm still thinking about it. So, and that's, I think, what makes your film special.
Oh, and, thank you so much. That everyone will be happy to hear that.
So, just getting back to the production of Demolisher, so any choice anecdotes about the actually filming the movie?
Oh, boy. There's so much stuff. I'm trying to think if there was anything. There were long days because of the locations. I mean, that's the one thing, too. This movie had so many locations. Like, if you sit there with a piece of paper and write down all the locations, like pawn shop, inside a bus, cemetery, under a bridge in Hamilton, like... This, like, and those are four right there that are, like, you know, I mean, there was just so many locations. The days were just nuts, so we sometimes had to cheat a lot of things, make one location into three, make one location into four, and I know the opening shot of the film, with Samantha's character on the floor, that was actually shot in the actress's hotel room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because, you know, we figured, why not? You know, no one's going to know it's a hotel room. We just need a dark-looking room, and, you know. So we did a lot of stuff like that. I mean, obviously, for independent low-budget filmmaking, you do that anyways, but nothing too crazy. I mean, there are some stories, you know, it's just long days, and I can't think if there's anything crazy. Oh, wait, we do have one, actually. This is probably one of my favorite ones. There's a shot in the film, and when people movie. I want them to look for it. Because whenever I see it, I'm like, you can't even buy that. There's a shot where the Demolisher is walking down an alleyway during the chase sequence. And behind him, a cop car drives by. And they turn on their little whoop-whoop thing.
I noticed that, yep.
That was completely unplanned.
Wow.
It happened on one shot only.
Huh.
That cop car was a real city cop car. He was walking down that alley, and a cop car passed just in time, just even perfectly, as he moves his shoulders, you know, like, gracefully to the right side of the frame, you see the cop car just drive by, and as soon as we saw that on camera, and whilst we were rolling, and we were just, like, gutting it, like, just like, oh my, did that actually happen? And then, of course, that shot's going to stay in post, because stuff like that, you can't, like, that would have cost thousands of bucks,
uh-huh.
You know, like, to get a cop car, and to plan that, to time that, like, how many takes it would have been to get that perfect, that moment, you know, so, that's the one little, I know it's not a big story, but it's the one little shot moment in the film that I'm pretty excited about.
Well, that's pretty incredible, because, I mean, talk about serendipity, and I mean, that, again, like, that really kind of fits into, again, some of the other themes of the film, I mean, you know, in terms of safety and security and lack thereof, so, I mean, wow, I mean, you could have asked for something more fortunate to happen to you guys when you're...
Oh, I know, and it's funny, because while we were filming around the city, we would see cop cars, so we would always try to point our cameras toward them, and, you know, we'd walkie-talkie, like, avoid the logos, avoid the city, like, try to just... get like that. Anyways, because there's a few other shots that are like that were caught by mistake, but that one definitely looks the best. And I mean, other than our 20-hour days and our amazing camera crew, it was crazy. It was a crazy shoot, fun, but just nuts. Came out of location.
So you guys,
I think it's because my last film all took place in one location, in House
right,
of Flies.
House of Flies. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I always vow to never do another movie where it's in one location again.
So, I mean, you guys played Fantasia.
Yes, that
and
was great.
How was the reception there?
Oh, it was amazing. It was, we had a sold-out show, and some of the press that came out of that, we were so thankful for, you know, because, you know, we're very small. It's, you know, we're a small indie team here at Lake Fox, and, you know, we had no money to hire a publicity or PR company. Or anything like that, and I mean, I do all the graphics and the posters myself on Photoshop and stuff, and I mean, so getting that reception and some of the reviews that came out of that, we were just really lucky, you know, that caught on, and then, yeah, October's a big month. It's weird because it feels like the film has played more than once, but it has only played once.
Huh.
And October it's playing for Adam in Mexico, and then it's playing VIF, the Vancouver International Film Festival. Then it's playing Hardline. Well, it just played Hardline in Germany. Then it's playing Stitches in Spain. It's playing another festival I can't announce yet. And then it's playing Dead Fest in Edmonton, and then Toronto After Dark, and then it's playing another festival in the UK.
Huh.
This is all just October. So we're kind of lucky, too, where we just have a nice, huge run of it in October, and then, you know, before the Christmas season starts, before December, we kind of wind down in November and see where it goes in the new year.
Well, I mean, it's a really unique film, and I think, you know, as you start to roll it out in festivals and word-of-mouth bills, I mean, people are going to start to really, you know, discover this thing and think, you know, discover
something. I hope so. I hope so. It will be coming out on Blu-ray in Germany in the new year, early 2016. And we also locked a deal with South Korea. Or, sorry, not South Korea. I think it's, South Korea. Which is interesting. So it's really interesting to see, even from a sales perspective, where this film is, where people are really, really liking it, and really gravitating toward it first, before there's any movement behind it, and the Germans were the first ones on it.
Huh.
They jumped on it like dogs. Even I think it was before Fantasia. We had something with them in place. They're definitely helping.
Well, actually, I mean, I'm you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the film again at. Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I want to see it on the big screen.
This is definitely a theater film, mm-hmm. and whenever people watch the online screeners for reviews, I quench because at Fantasia we had two reviewers after the screening or the thing that, you know, people are talking. They came up to me and they're like, "Oh, by the way, I'm blah blah blah. I reviewed your film." I'm like, "Oh, you did?" And they're like, "This is our second time seeing it." And it's a completely different film. The second time, we're going to have to go rewrite a review. And I'm like, "What do you mean?" They're like, "For the better." Like, I said, I know. It's a different experience in the theater. I don't know why. I know everyone says that about their films. But I think with some films, it's important to see it in a theatrical environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because the sound and the score of, like, a necklace really resonates on a good system, and that's really important because it's a very sonic film.
Yeah.
With the score, it definitely evokes emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just listening to it on a flat screen TV with, you know, Vimeo stream or whatnot, it's, you're missing out on so much, and I can appreciate now why even music artists, even artists like Trent Reznor, you know, why they offer the highest quality outputs for their albums available for listeners. Because it does evoke something on a whole new level. And that's really important. So that's new to me as well, that I'm going to definitely carry on, I think.
Any plans on releasing a soundtrack?
100%, yeah. It's coming out on iTunes any day now. The artist, Glenn Nichols, he's from a group called Future Funk Squad. He's UK-based. I've never met him. He actually made the score before we started filming. He read the script and loved it, and then we went on from there. And we used that score to help us write the script, even, because he just had, like, this huge point-form thing, an idea. And then when we started writing the script, we sent it to him, he'd read it, you know, he'd score to it, and then the original film was all based on cue cards. So it had the thing of bristleboard, and all the scenes were on a cue card, and that's where the whole visual approach for the film took place. So you could see the arcs and see things on a visual perspective. And then a couple of weeks before shooting, we made the 48-page script. But his score was incredible, and he has so much stuff that's even better that's in the film that didn't make the cut.
Wow.
Because so much of it, and it was so good that if some of it's even better, and I don't know why we couldn't use it, but it just didn't fit. You know what I mean? When you have something that's so good, but oh, it doesn't fit. So he's coming out. He has the album out. We gave him, you know, he has authority over it, and he's working with Lee Fox Pictures, and so that's definitely coming on iTunes, I think this month or next month. I think it's October 28th is the iTunes launch date for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know next year we are planning to have a vinyl release and a CD of the score as well, some physical copies.
Awesome.
There's some very cool art has been done for the film as well, so we want to kind of package that up and, you know, because we're fans of the vinyl and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah,
too, everything.
Same here.
Alt recordings has been doing and whatnot.
I want to thank you for chatting with us, and I'm looking forward to, as I said to you before, I mean, you know, seeing you at TAD and seeing the film again and, you know, shaking your hand.
That's amazing. No, thank you so much for having me on the show. This is incredible, and yeah, thanks for giving us the time and day and sitting down to watch this little film we did. You know, it means a lot, you know. Like, it really does, because it's an hour and a half of your life. So, just glad you checked it out and got something from it. Yeah.
So now we're talking with Jessica Vanno, who plays Marie in The Demolisher. And Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you. I wanted to ask you, how did you get the role in The Demolisher?
I worked with one of the producers on a previous movie, Rod Barrett, and he kind of thought that I was a good suit for the role, so he put me up for the part in front of the director. I had a couple meetings with Gabriel, and he also thought I was a perfect fit, so it went from there.
Now, of course, Rod Barrett plays quote-unquote, the Demolisher, who plays Bruce. And
yes.
Although the film is ostensibly Bruce's story, I would argue that it's very much Marie's as well. Your character bookends the film and has an extremely interesting character arc. What are your thoughts on Marie's journey?
You know, I love Marie's journey, and it's very much parallels her story and Bruce's story throughout the film. They're all kind of dealing with this darkness that they're trying to overcome. I do love Marie's journey throughout the film because she's dealing with some stuff in her personal life and some medical issues. And basically, it's just, she fought through it, fought through the night. She had the will to live, and that kind of translates into everybody's story in the film.
Would you say that your character is almost as important to the movie as Bruce's?
I have to say that, but I do think that the characters, they go really well together in that story, and I think each story is just as important to the final message.
They make an incredible counterpoint to one another, especially in terms of how they cope with trauma and tragedy in their lives. Now, your role required you to, take some emotional turns and some physical turns. First, we'll talk about the emotional turns and the emotional. What was it like filming those more emotional scenes for you?
Having the script, it was kind of more of an outline. Gabriel gave us a lot of room to play as artists, so being able to take those emotional moments and kind of go with it on your own was an incredible thing for an actor to be able to do. So the emotion was great. Working with Ryan Barrett and Tiana Nori, they're just pros, mm-hmm. So they kind of brought out the best in everybody, in each other, and the emotional moments ended up, I think, looking very, very good.
Mm-hmm. And what about the physical moments? I mean, did you have to undergo some training, or?
It was definitely the most physically demanding shoot that I've done. But that kind of helped me throughout the filming, bring her character to life as well, because hours of running, I personally had to get myself through the days, and I kind of think that it translated very well on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was very physical. I slept for about 5 years after we finished filming.
And without giving too much away, when I'm talking about the physicality, I mean, there's a couple scenes involving your character that are absolutely brutal to watch. And, kudos, I guess, to the cinematographer and the director for making it mm-hmm. look so punishing. But were you able to sort of get through it unscathed, quote-unquote?
I believe you're talking about that one slow shot,
yes.
Which was Martin Bezzora was just incredible. So there's this one shot in the film, which is my favorite, and it's, it's like a slow, long shot of mm-hmm. me and Ryan Barrett, and he choreographed that scene, and, put Martin Bezzora behind the camera and Gabriel directing it, and it became a pretty epic scene to watch, and Ryan Barrett took care of me, made sure that I wasn't doing anything super dangerous, so it looks great, but I didn't get hurt or anything.
Well, that's good, because as I said before, it looks absolutely brutal, and I'm sure that audiences will cringe when they see it, as I did as I was watching it.
Yeah, I mean, the 20th take, I was kind of just like, did we get it yet? But it wasn't that bad. As long as it looks good on screen, that's all I care about, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, the film has played Fantasia. Were you at the premiere in Montreal?
Yes, I was. Yeah, we went there. My family drove up from Prince Edward Island to come watch it with us as well. So it was a pretty incredible experience.
Mm-hmm. And the audience, I was talking to Gabriel about the audience reaction. He said the audience reacted really, really well. And mm-hmm. Now you guys have the Toronto After Dark, basically the Toronto premiere coming up at TAD. And you're a local girl, right? You're from Toronto?
I'm living here. I'm actually from Prince Edward Island.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, but I do. It is the hometown premiere, and I do have lots of friends and family in this area that I'm super excited to show it to in Toronto. So mm-hmm. it feels, although I'm from PEI, it still feels like a hometown premiere.
You must be then super excited for the premiere, and seeing it with your friends and family here.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a big screen.
And hopefully.
My face is going to be real big.
So let's talk about your, you know, your beginnings in acting. What made you want to decide to become an actress?
Yeah, it's a crazy story, actually. I went to university, UPEI, for business, and I was taking a theater elective. You know, I said, oh, well, let me take this bird course to get through. And then I ended up just absolutely falling in love with it. I caught the acting bug, and I told my parents, guess what, guys? I'm quitting business, and I'm going to become an actress. So they weren't thrilled, but they're happy now. So, I packed up, I moved to Toronto, and hit the pavement and found an agent, and now we are where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny how sometimes those bird courses end up becoming, you know, what you end up following in life. I sort of had a similar experience myself,
yeah,
but...
Exactly, and I was like, I feel bad that I ever even called it a bird course, you know? it's definitely not. It was my career, it was my passion, so...
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen you in another film. You're in Berkshire County.
Yes, yeah. Oh, you know what? That was one of my first experiences on set in Toronto. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. The director, Audrey Cummings, she's great. The lead in that, Alyssa King, she's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It was a short part, but it was, I couldn't have asked for a better entry onto set. You know, I learned a lot from the couple days that I was there, and the movie turned out great, so I'm very happy to be a part of that one.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, between Berkshire County and The Demolisher, I mean, Berkshire County is definitely a horror film. The Demolisher is, I would say, not quite a horror, it's a genre film,
yeah.
You know, vigilante revenge film, but as I was saying to Gabriel, a very, very smart one. It goes well beyond, you know, your standard, like, Death Wish or Nail Gun Massacre, what have you.
Yeah, breaks the mold, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so, is this a path that you sort of consciously picked in terms of acting in genre films, or did it sort of... kind of fall in that way?
Yeah, I kind of fell into it. The first lead that I had was a film called Manifesto, and it's just finishing up post-production right now. That's where I actually met Brett Garrett on that set as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also like a horror thriller.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of went from, you know, that onto the next, and I did kind of fall into this genre, and I love it. I absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to expand a little bit. I just finished a kids movie with Brainpower Studios and Dare 2 Productions. So that was awesome. It was kind of like Breakfast Club meets X-Men. So it was very, it's awesome. It was very awesome to do something different and outside of the box. So, yeah, I did fall into the genre, but I'm definitely not just, you know, solely doing it.
Right. But, I mean, of course, going to festivals and stuff such as Fantasia and with the upcoming After Dark, I mean, I'm sure you've met a lot of fans. What are your impressions of, quote-unquote, horror fans or genre fans?
I love them. You know, they're so passionate. They're, unlike any genre of film that I've come across, they're so passionate about it. You know, they show up in costumes and decked out, and they know everything about, not only, you know, like, the film, they know everything about the actors and the directors and the DOP, like, they know everything about the whole production, which is just really nice for people to dive that deep into film instead of just being like, oh, I love, you know, this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, so yeah, it's nice. They're great. I love them.
Now, you mentioned, you know, of course, Rye getting you into this movie, and I'm going to be talking to him next.
Yeah.
Is there anything that, you know, maybe a little scoop about Rye Barrett, so I can kind of throw him off on with a little bit of insight?
I think I might get in trouble. I think I might not know too much about Rye.
Or maybe a fun anecdote from the set, perhaps, or...
Oh, yeah. You know what? I will tell the story, because it was hilarious. We were doing the scene, and it was this intense scene. It didn't actually end up making the final cut, but it was just me and my girlfriend, and we were talking in our front room in the movie, and it was, oh god, it was like 4 a.m, and we were all just wiped at this point. And we were in the middle of delivering our lines, and there's just this ridiculous snoring starts. And we're like, I kind of delivered a line, and then the snoring continued, and I kind of stopped. I was like, what's going on? I looked over, and Rye Barrett was fast asleep. I'm like just out of frame under the kitchen table on set. That movie took a toll on him, but it paid off. He's incredible in that film.
Unbelievable. And I mean, it's because, I mean, his character is so intense.
they're so damaged, and he just plays it. He plays it like I've never seen that before. You know, he plays it. You want to feel for him. You don't know if you want to, and it's that's what he wanted to come across. You know, he wanted to make the audience either, you know, feel like they want to root for him, and then not, and he just knocks it out of the park.
Well, yeah, I mean that's one thing that you know, you have to give credit to Gabriel for, because with, you know, this genre, the vigilante film, I mean, you want to, you're conditioned to root for, in this case, the Demolisher, but the way this film is, yeah, you're rooting for him at the beginning, but then basically because of your character, you know, it really plays around with your allegiances, and although you still want to root for him because, hey, he's the Demolisher, and he's wearing a really cool suit, and he's providing these really kick-ass beatdowns, you're like, I want to, but I don't know if I can or if I should.
Yeah, and that's, I know. The second that he goes off the rails, you've got to question everything, right?
Mm-hmm. And that sort of moral ambiguity, I think, is what really raises this film above your typical standard, you know, as I said before, Death Wish or Executioner or Nail Gun Massacre.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course.
And, of course, with your character being the catalyst for that sort of shift in, you know, for some people. You know, some people are just going to go with him for the entire movie. Other people are going to be on your side. It's really, really unique in that sense. But your character, in my opinion, also gives the film a very unique sense of empowerment.
Yeah, no, I do. She's a very strong girl. You know, a grit girl. That's what I like to call her. I describe her. She has a lot of grit throughout the film, and it's interesting seeing the dynamic between the two. And then I won't give it away, but the ending is just, you know, I think perfect for their struggles.
It's incredible. And I mean, there's two things I don't want to give away that I found near the end. Two particular things that happened that really just sort of hammered home, you know, like the real sort of moral ambiguity, as well as sort of like the parallels with it. Not just, also, I'm also talking about now Tiana's character as well. Was it Samantha? I forget. It's Samantha, correct?
Yes,
Samantha. Yeah, it's just incredible. I mean, it's just like, you know, three character story arc where you're really, you know, rooting and then not knowing who to root for, and just a really, really powerful film.
Everybody has their demons, and the kind of the theme of the movie is just kind of trying to get out from that darkness, right?
Mm-hmm. And even, I mean, Gabriel's like, I mean, even with your character, he goes, you know, I didn't want to make her 100% likable either. You know, I mean, there's elements of Marie that you may not like. So,
yeah.
It's great. It's great to see a movie that really does ask questions of the audience, and, you know, like, three different people watch it and have three different interpretations or three different feelings. I mean, it'll be interesting. I'm going to be seeing it on the big screen for the second time at TAD. I'm looking forward to seeing the audience reaction.
Great. Yeah, that's awesome. Like, what we try to go for here is we're not slapping the audience in the face with the answers. And I feel like I love going to cinema where you kind of finish the film and everybody sits there for a couple seconds like, so what do you think? What do you think? Well, because this and that, you know, they ask questions. I like that. And so that's what we kind of went for, and I think that we achieved it for sure.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely think you did. So you mentioned the sort of more family-friendly film that you're working on right now. What else is in the pipeline for you?
Yeah, so, I just wrapped that one in July. And then this one that me and Rad Barrett actually did a couple years ago, Manifesta, we just did some reshoots for that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we kind of twisted the story a little bit. So that one's coming down the line soon, hopefully. And then, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what's up after TAD.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
We're talking with Rye Barrett. Rye plays the titular Demolisher. He plays Bruce. Now, Rye has been in a number of films, including In the House of Flies, Never Lost, If a Tree Falls, The Drownsman, Antisocial, Ejecta, and now The Demolisher. So you've been acting since 2005.
A little before that. That first film was released that we did in 2005. I think we shot it about 2 years before that, though.
Now, one thing I was, because I was, you know, looking at your IMDb credits, and I was quite impressed that on The Demolisher, I mean, you kind of wore many hats. I mean, besides being The Demolisher, you also were the action coordinator and the stunt coordinator, and in the past you've also worked as a writer and a set director. You've directed, you've done special effects, sound.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of everything. I mean, I'm no no master of any of those, I'd say. But yeah, I try to do a little bit of everything, so I kind of know everything where I'm coming from.
How did you get into the biz initially?
It actually was with Gabriel and our other friend Chad Archibald, directing Drowned.
Yeah.
We had all gotten together, and they were planning to shoot a film that was eventually to be called Best of Souls. And they asked me to come to a meeting, and I thought it was just to help out with sort of behind-the-scenes stuff, either behind the camera or stuff like that, because I had that experience. But they asked me to play the lead, and then it just kind of took off from there. I did a couple other roles, and then the more that I did, the more serious I got about it, and then exactly later, here we are.
Was it always your ambition to work in film?
No, it wasn't at all, actually. I mean, I always loved drama, and I always loved the arts, and before doing the switch over to film, I used to play in a couple of different bands, a couple of different rock bands, punk bands, whatever. So my focus was more kind of on music and stuff, and then Dust and Souls came along, and it kind of fully switched over from there.
Your work has primarily been in genre films. Was that a sort of like a conscious choice as your career progressed?
Not necessarily. There just tends to be a lot more genre independent films that are just being made. I'm an actor first. I'll pretty much go for anything that is a good role, that offers a good role. And like starting off, obviously you don't have those options. You kind of take whatever you can get at the beginning, and I mean, it's more or less just whatever comes my way, and if whatever I'm reading for, if it's a comedy, if it's a horror, if it's a revenge film, as long as it's quality, then it's something I want to do.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of good roles, I mean, your character, Bruce in The Demolisher, is, I mean, he's definitely one of those instantly iconic characters. When you see the guy walking around and kicking ass in riot gear, I mean, he's, like I said, he just kind of leaps off the screen. When you first were offered the role, or when you first read the script, I mean, how much of Bruce was on the page, and how much did you add to it?
Me and Gabe know each other pretty well. We go back pretty far. So we had a lot of there was a lot of chatting going on, like in the first initial, like when the first outline that he sent me, like I don't think Bruce really. He wasn't at all the character that he came to be. So there was a lot of back and forth, and a lot of kind of ideas flying around back and forth, and throughout that, the whole sort of outline and Phil's idea behind the whole thing changed. He came back with like another draft of it, and it was just a completely different animal, and it was all about characters this time, and that was the thing that really got me excited about the project.
Yeah, because when I was talking with Gabriel, I mean, one thing that we discussed, I mean, the fact that The Demolisher is not your typical vigilante revenge film. I mean, it's not your Death Wish, it's not your Nail Gun Massacre. I mean, it's very cerebral. I mean, it's a lot more character oriented, and which I, in my opinion, makes it stand out from the bunch. And you acted as one of the producers on the film as well. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And Gabriel was saying how, yeah, you know, it could have been really easy to go for these, you know, pure exploitative elements, and I sort of wanted to at certain points, but the producer said, no, let's keep it the way, you know, let's just rein it in, let's make it, you know, something a little bit more character-based, and I think that, you know, like I said, it paid off. I mean, it's a really fantastic movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the main things that, like, what I was just saying about those early drafts, that was one of the big things. I was like, do you want to just kind of do this thing that's already been done, or do it? And Gabe was all for it too. Like he was like, no, I want to make this something completely different. And he kept coming back with these different ideas, these different interpretations. And the more we got into it, the more we just kind of talked back and forth and built these characters. And he got to sit down, like we each kind of individually talked about these characters and built them into what they eventually became. And I think that is one of the things that really comes across in this, as opposed to other like Death Wish, Death Sentence, and you know your classics and stuff. But we wanted to be different. We wanted the guy going after the vengeance to be actually, you know, falling apart himself, and to be able to see that happen.
And that's the thing too. I mean, what you just mentioned. I mean, as the film progresses, Bruce goes through some incredible emotional breakdowns, and your performance is nothing if not intense and also very heartbreaking. And some of the scenes, I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but I mean, some of the scenes, some of the breakdowns are, I'm actually hard to watch, but I mean, really, you know, you could really feel it. And I want to ask you, what did you draw on for those scenes?
You know what? Kind of one of those things where it's just kind of, I know where I'm going to go for those scenes, and I kind of, I got my different areas where I'm going to go for it, and then when you shoot the scenes, I just kind of go there. I know we're only going to be shooting it so many times, so I just find wherever that spot has to be, listen to whatever music I need to, or find that emotion. You know, there's always a different kind of trigger for it, but, I don't really have a specific method for every single time. It kind of always changes, so whatever gets it done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if nothing, you know, your performance is nothing if not intensity, and I mean, it's pure performance because, you know, there's very minimal dialogue, and most of it comes through in your body language and your presence and your posture. And again, was this something that you sort of like rehearsed, or was it when you like put on the costume, you just felt it and it came out, or how did Bruce evolve?
Yeah, we did quite a bit of rehearsing for very specific scenes. And leading into those scenes and just to get a feel of the tone and the pacing and stuff. And I think that was a huge precursor to tell us. Yeah, because there's a lot of it that was, we made up a few things as we went along. And as long as we all knew our characters down to the key, we knew the tone, we knew the pacing, we knew where the scene had to go, Gabe left us free to kind of wander with our characters. And that's where some of those things came there, yeah, just through interactions and through both of us knowing whoever the other person was in the scene, just knowing where we had to be and where we were going with it.
How did it feel to walk around though in that suit? It must have felt pretty kick ass just kind of walk around in that badass ride suit. And
it was pretty good badass. You know, the first time I wore it, I walked into the room and everyone just kind of stared at me because like the boots and everything, they had another like 2 or 3 inches. And I'm already 6'3" as it is, so
right.
it just made me look a lot bigger and more intimidated than I already am. So I mean, it was pretty badass wearing that and getting to go to town. And not only to mention that, but talking with doing all the stunts and having to do our own stunts and stuff with a small budget. You still take your bruises and you get hurt, but that suit did help me a lot to not get completely broken during the whole shoot.
I mean, when I was speaking with Jessica, I mean, I was saying there was one scene in particular which involves you and her character, which is an absolutely brutal scene, and it looked completely, like, I mean, to the viewer, it looks extremely, extremely intense and brutal, but she was saying, you know, testament to you as the sort of the action coordinator, the stunt coordinator, you know, she didn't get hurt at all, so...
Well, she was a trooper, too. I mean, like, I think I never seen her talking about the big showdown, and... We rehearsed that one a lot. We walked through it very slowly at first. We got it down on our marks. And then because it's a slow motion shot, you really have to make sure that all your hits just land exactly when they need to and everything. And we did that about 30 times at least, I'd say. And she was totally gung ho for the whole thing. So, she was a trooper. Dana was a trooper. Every guy and girl that we did the fight to, that they really brought it with them and made
count. And with Toronto After Dark coming up, are you excited for that premiere? The Toronto premiere?
I'm really excited for it. Toronto After Dark, you know, been going here for years. I wanted a film screen there, but it's always, you always get a little more nervous when it's kind of your home crowd, and this is more of a home crowd here, so at Fantasia, I didn't have to worry. I mean, you know, there's some people that we knew there and stuff for sure, but, here it can be a bigger group of people that we know. So it's a little more nerves that come with that screening. But I'm really excited for it. It's a great theater. It's a great festival, and it should be awesome.
Mm-hmm. When I got the opportunity to see it, I was expecting something more akin to, you know, your standard exploitative vigilante film, and ever since I saw it, I stopped thinking about it, and that's really a testament to all the work you guys put into it, because it really is something unique.
Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, and it's for that reason, I'm a big booster of the film, and I mean, I think this is a film that those genre fans really should take to, because it's really got a lot going for it.
Yeah, Yeah, well, thanks, Tom. We were hoping for that kind of reaction. I mean, you obviously always are. We're also of the mind that we know that, you know, some people are really going to get it and really dig it, and other people are just, you know, not so much. So we're hoping that there are more of the people just get what you got from it, which is what we were hoping. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, you take it as it comes, and you find something that works for each character in a different way. And Bruce, I always looked at Bruce as just a sort of bubbling volcano ready to explode. That was just, you know, just the surface of rage.
And I mean, without giving the ending away, I mean, it's a very unique ending, extremely suitable in terms of the entire film. I mean, it definitely, there's some, in my opinion, there's some symbolism to a lot of different aspects of some of the different characters in the movie, and the final shot is sort of incredible. And I wouldn't say it's, you know, it makes it ripe for a sequel, but it kind of makes it look like, hey, you know what, we might see Bruce again. I mean, has there been any talks about that?
I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, there's no for sure, and there's no, you know, there's no yeses or noes, but there's been talk of it, and I don't know, it would have to be the right idea, and have to be the right kind of thing to do, but I think it was left open for that reason, too, to also let people, so, you know, like during Halloween, where it's like, he's still out there, he's still, what's he going to do next, kind of thing.
That's quite a quite an appropriate analogy, I think, in terms of, you know, Halloween and Mike Myers, he's still out there, and Bruce, I mean, he's still out there.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of, you know, those endings that leave you hanging, and it can kind of go either way, and we'll leave it up to the future to decide that.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I mean, at the end of the movie, I mean, the cumulative effect is that I think audiences will be divided, but I don't think divided in terms of the quality of the film. I'm pretty confident in my fellow genre fans that they're going to be like, yeah, this is a great film, but divided in terms of, you know, their allegiances and what they think, and as I said to Gabriel, I mean, that's the mark of an incredible movie, where at the end of the film, you're like, well, you know, half the audience is going to say, yeah, I mean, this guy's kick-ass, I love him, half the audience is going to be like, well, I don't know, and it's going to cause a lot of discussion and a lot of debate, so...
Yeah, if people walking away talking about the film, then mission accomplished.
Well, I want to thank you for chatting with us.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks.
And also, I want to, you know, congratulations on The Demolisher, and as I said before, I look forward to seeing it on the big screen.
All right, thank you, and I'll probably see you at Toronto Bearcat.
Definitely.